Hello everyone and welcome to the next edition of the VTX podcast. Here at the Veterinary Thought Exchange, we'd like to start by asking, what are you thinking? And this week we're going to be thinking and chatting with the wonderful Jess. Now Jess is a veterinary surgeon, but her role now is really to focus on the people part of our profession, as she works with vets and veterinary teams to build resilience and emotional intelligence amongst many, many other things. I absolutely loved my conversation with Jess, and there were so many things that stuck out for me. We spoke about preaching what you practice, we spoke about imposter syndrome, but imposter syndrome in a slightly different way. How about imposter syndrome in advance? And probably one of the most powerful things we spoke about was the equal and opposite truth, and how we all spend a lot of time getting inside our own heads. In our clinical segment today, we're joined by Lucy and Katie from Protexin, where we're going to have a super interesting discussion about some of the challenges of speaking and approaching behavioural concerns in small animal practice. Okay, well, we're really excited to be joined by Jess today. Thank you so much for joining us and taking the time to chat to us. I wonder if you could start just for the listeners, just explaining a little bit really about who you are and what you do and why what you do is so exciting.
Sure. Like every human on the planet, love talking about me.
What a strong start. I love that. We're going to start strong and just be like, I really enjoy this. I love that.
Yeah. Well, I'm supposed to be here to talk about other people, but you know, you've got to get your own little moment of fame in there.
Yeah, exactly. So
I'm originally a veterinarian from West Australia, though I've spent a lot of my career elsewhere. But my big passion in the industry, having spent most of my career in leadership roles, is really the people part of the animal industry. And, you know, so having done everything from run RSPCAs to, you know, manage the wildlife departments at Taronga Zoo to, running specialist hospitals and my own business, I pretty much have a really singular focus that I believe that if we focus on getting the people part of our industry right, and we really sort of genuinely, rather than just kind of tick box exercises, we put our people first, that is the way to success in our industry. And I'm kind of on a mission to prove it one way or another. So I work with a lot of vet clinics on everything from, you know, how they can improve the well-being and resilience and emotional intelligence and just the culture of their teams, to working with vets who are struggling with working out, where do I fit in the veterinary industry? Do I still fit in this industry, or am I not the right fit, and do I need to find a way out of this, and what does that look like for me? And, you know, really about keeping people well and engaged and resilient in whichever part of the industry that we can find that fits them best.
So you started out, obviously, you know, doing your veterinary degree. Just remind me where you did that again.
West Australia. So I'm a Murdoch graduate.
I love that you say West Australia, like I'm going to know where that, like, I'm like, I was, in my mind, I was like, oh, I don't know what that means.
Perth is the city, okay. But Western Australia is like actually a state that takes up nearly half of our country. So it's a bit like saying California. It's the whole west coast of the country.
Yeah. So it's the bit that's away from Sydney. Is that right?
Yes. The most isolated capital city in the world, I believe.
Oh, there you go. Right. These are things we're learning. So, okay. So you, and correct me if I'm wrong, you know, you probably had different expectations of what your veterinary career would look like versus what it is now. So what did you think that the veterinary degree was going to give you?
I was, you know, very much like so many people who join our industry, really believed wholeheartedly that it was the only thing I could possibly do with my life. And, you know, I remember waiting for my university entrance results just devastated at the idea that I might be stuck with medicine. I was the pretty classic. This was what I was meant to do from when I was a really young kid. But I think I was possibly luckier than many because I was only halfway through my veterinary degree when I was starting to question, maybe this isn't for me. Maybe my brain doesn't work like the other people in this course. Maybe, I'm not the same structure in terms of how I think and how I go about things and what things I enjoy as the people that I'm seeing succeed in this industry. But I was really lucky that we have a very terrifying equine lecturer who still lectures there. And so anybody who went to Murdoch will know who I mean, Dr. Anne Barnes. But she overheard me once on a prac telling my friends that I don't think I'll be a vet for very long because it's not for me. And she, in her very terrifying way, basically verbally beat me over the head with her, saying, how dare you? Please don't assume that, just because you're not a clinician anymore, you're not a vet. What is a vet if not somebody who works to improve animal welfare? And you can do that in a billion different ways. And I think I was really lucky.
That's quite, I mean, I
Sorry.
suppose that's, but terrifying, but also actually. For me, that's quite a wise thing to be told at that stage in your career. And I don't know that I was ever aware of that at that stage in vet school. I think there's a lot of people that have a voice that tells you that now, in the actual industry. But I think it's quite unusual to hear that someone said that during vet school and then was told, well, actually, hold on a second, that's you're not thinking about this in the right way. And actually, as you were speaking, I was thinking of, a friend, a very good friend of mine who really struggled in vet school. I think feeling like this maybe wasn't for her. And now she has a wonderful career doing things helping animal welfare, but not being directly a clinician. And I wonder whether it would have helped to be told that, you know what I mean? So that's quite a helpful thing to hear.
Because one of the things I hear all the time from people who are struggling with the industry is that sort of feeling of stuckness or the feeling of, but if I give up now, I'm wasting all of those years I put into this learning curve, or I'm wasting my university degree or whatever. And I think to have had really early on that knowledge that there isn't only one path to success here. And so when I got out, graduated, actually, it really wasn't for me. Rather than kind of feeling that sense of failure, which I know a lot of my colleagues have felt when they've not feeling like veterinary is working for them, I was great because I got to go, oh well, what next? How do I use this as a stepping platform up to what's the next thing? And I think knowing that early and being self-aware enough to have recognized quite early on, this doesn't feel like what I thought it was going to feel like, and I don't think how some of the most successful vets I know think. I think that made a big difference.
Yeah, I wonder. There's, there's a few things there, but I think before we launch into that, I really want to know about the zoo. What, so can you just tell us about the zoo?
Sure. So I was for a couple of years there the manager of wildlife health for Sydney's sort of fairly iconic Taronga Zoo. So had the pretty impressive privilege of managing the vet clinic. So we had two zoos, the big one that you sort of imagine in your head that overlooks the harbour bridge and things. But we also had Dubbo Zoo, which is this really wonderful free-ranging zoo about 5 hours inland from Sydney. So manage the vet teams, clinical pathology, nutrition, the pathology team, that sort of stuff. And to be honest, it was about as cool a job as you would think it is, actually. Just exceptionally impressive place to work doing, this organization just really puts its money where its mouth is and does amazing things globally. Amazingly talented colleagues who quite literally wrote the book on a whole bunch of things, Nobody knows the appropriate analgesia dose of paracetamol in a koala. So, let's find out and let's be the people who decide those things and can tell other people the answers to that question,
Isn't
which
that
is
cool?
really, really good.
Yeah, like, wake up one day and be like, so What paracetamol dose does a koala need? I mean, those are thoughts that I've never had until now, but now I feel like I'm gonna look that up. But that's very cool, isn't it? What I mean, I think so there's there's a message here that, you've decided that sort of maybe conventional clinical career in veterinary medicine is not for you. And I think it really is, empowering to hear you maybe making that decision earlier on and being comfortable with that. But I suppose, regardless of how comfortable you are with the fact that you might not be doing veterinary medicine in that classic way, how do you make a decision about what you're then going to do? I mean, how does that work? So you wake up one day and you decide that maybe that's not for you, but how do you take that the step further?
Yeah, look, there's a million steps, and it really depends a little bit where you are on your pathway. And for a lot of people, the first step is just working out what dysfunctional beliefs are keeping them where they are. A lot of people have this kind of, either financially, which is, I'm not belittling the financial concern of leaping, but at the same time, that can be a barrier that we put in place without really realizing it's not a real barrier for most people. We're not living on the poverty line. It's a priorities barrier about what we want to do. But even without that, we often sit in these beliefs of, oh, only really, smarter people than me or braver people than me do something else with it. Or we sit in this dysfunctional belief around, oh, well, it will have wasted my time if I get out now. Or, that the grass isn't greener, so I'm expecting too much, all of those sorts of things. So I think more than anything, the first step is always, why haven't you changed yet? What's keeping you stuck and feeling where you are? But once you have kind of worked through that and decided that, okay, clinical practice is not where I want to spend my career, then it's about trying to work out, well, who am I? Rather than what do I want to do, the best question to ask yourself is who you want to be. Because one of the mistakes I see all of the time is people who kind of go, okay, well, this job isn't working for me, so I'll change jobs and that'll fix the problem. As opposed to what is it that you're want out of your life, and that's really important, not just out of your career, out of your life. And then how do we fit a career into that? Because if you are the sort of person who steps through your life taking a job or doing the next logical step, whether that's, dating your high school girlfriend and then, getting engaged and then getting the practice baby Labrador and then getting married and then you have 1.3 children, 2 years later, those very default steps that society sets out for us. What happens then is that your life is just forced to fit in around your career because that's the career path you've chosen. So you follow that trajectory and everything else just has to fit in. So I really, really encourage people to step back and look at what do you want out of your life? What, balance of work and life and money and finances and family and travel and those sorts of things are important to you. And then how are we going to make that happen for you in a way that fits with who you are and the things that can bring you joy in the workplace?
I think though that's, I mean, when you say that out loud, I think it's very, it sounds amazing. And I think it's very, very sensible and logical what you're saying. I think the reality of that is just, I don't know if that's just challenging for people to get their head around. And I think, I saw one thing the other day, which I thought was interesting. I think we're often, I think, very good, particularly on social media, at sort of, saying the things that we think we should say or do or behave and project in a way that we think is the right way to be, as far as, being kind to each other and, being inclusive and obviously not being, I don't know, obvious thing, not being racist or not being
Don't be a dick,
trans,
basically.
do 100%. Don't be trans. Don't be a dick, right? So we all kind of project that, but actually, is that really the reality of how we're truly behaving? And I love that question, right? Okay, so you tell everyone on Instagram that you are not transphobic or something, but is that really the way you're behaving? Do you know what I mean? Like, I think that it was just an interesting way of thinking about it. And I think that, I wonder if the idea of all of this and is good, but I wonder, is the doing of it really that achievable?
The doing of it is a pretty big leap of faith. There is no doubt about it. And living, your values and deciding to go for what you want is really, really hard work. I'm somebody who, even in my personal life, decided I want a family, can't find the man of my dreams, so I'm going to do it by myself. And the process to get there in terms of the courage to jump off, actually jump in, and then living every single day as a solo mum by choice and having to have committed to a path that, isn't the traditional one. It isn't the cliche on Facebook. It isn't just, be brave and, step outside the square. It's life and it's hard work. And I think that that's a really important part to acknowledge, that no matter which journey you take, you're going to have to make compromises. You're going to have things that aren't perfect. You're going to be frustrated with days. Work is still work, frankly, most of the time. But the thing that I would say for most people who are sitting there going, well, that's all good and well for her or for these other people who are smarter or braver or better or, who have more money or have whatever that looks like, that are the reasons that they're finding it harder to jump, is you need somebody to hold your hand. And that is, realistically, somebody who holds you accountable for asking those hard questions, being really honest with yourself about the answers. Because sometimes when I coach people, the answers to the question is not, that they think that what they want is, this new career because everything will be better when I change jobs. And I actually have to coach them into going, well, right now, what I'm hearing is that you're unhappy in your job, and changing jobs isn't going to make you happy. Those external circumstances are only a part of what's going on for you. And so having someone in it with you and holding you accountable. But the other part of, and I always liken this, I do a lot of coaching inside vet clinics on resilience and mindset, is what we preach is still something we're practicing. So when I go into and I'm talking to somebody about questioning, or trying to challenge your initial perception of why somebody behaved the way they did, and trying to ask yourself why else they could have behaved, and maybe they're not just a dick, or maybe they have these other things going on in their life, or, challenging yourself to step out of sitting in a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy of negativity. I can say that all I like. I only practice it on a really good day 70% of the time. We are all human, and we all are just trying to make our way through. And every single day you have to make the choice again to be brave and to be bold and try something different, and that it's okay to fail at those things and start back again. And I think that work every day is more often what I see from these kind of career changes, more than this kind of big 3 month epiphany of suddenly now I'm happy because I did this huge overhaul of my life.
Right. I agree. I think that's absolutely right. And I also think that people need to and I can only speak from my personal experience, but I would say to people from my own experience, you can find a way. There is a way through this. And if someone is listening, and I know there will be, who just feels so stuck. And it's so funny because I was listening the other day to a podcast, which was the science of becoming unstuck, was the kind of theme of the whole thing. And I think that this plays into so much of how we feel. And it's taken me almost 20 years to find a path through this, and lots of mechanisms, not just one thing, not just one epiphany, and then everything changed. I'm just about to start my clinical day now, and I have every single time that day comes around, 3 days a week, I have to think about how I'm approaching that day. And it's that the that's the difference, that I've had to just work on so many different elements of how I approach the whole thing. And I do enjoy it now, truly do enjoy it now, but that's taken such a lot of time and such a lot of effort. And one of the other things I'd really like, I really when you were speaking was this idea that I think often we all feel that we're the worst. Like in our minds we're the worst, right? Like no one can be as bad as me. No one can be as rubbish as me. No one can be as awful at me at doing this. Why am I struggling with this? Why is everyone else succeeding? Like even with everything, you must hear that with the people that you coach. Like I think that, when I don't know, for instance, I gave up drinking alcohol almost a year ago, so I've been almost a year sober. But through that journey, through that journey, I have been at every turn, I'm like, yeah, but no one was as bad as me. No one drank as much as me. No one behaved the way I did. No one, do you know what I mean, made the mistakes I did. And it was the same mentality. No one can be as bad as me. And I think that's no one, and I think that's often the mindset people have in that stuckness. You're just at the bottom of the
Only other
pile.
people can get out of this.
Right? Do you not hear that?
I do a lot. It's a really common, and again, it's just those dysfunctional beliefs that are keeping people where they are. They other people can change, but I'm just me. I'm just, I don't have that thing that she has or that thing that he has, or I don't know how to do it, or if I did know how to do it, I'd fail at it anyway. Those kind of, almost imposter syndrome, but imposter syndrome in advance.
I love in advance. I love that. That is that. That's like the worst type of imposter syndrome, where you're like, you're not even giving yourself a chance.
And women particularly, which we know dominate our industry, are particularly bad at imposter syndrome in any setting, but let alone the in advance version of it, where they're worrying about whether they're qualified for something they haven't even applied for. They're thinking about how they wouldn't be possibly qualified to do a thing before it's even a possibility. And it's just such a pointless exercise. So women are just particularly susceptible to the imposter syndrome in advance. And so I do a lot of work on what it, I got a great tip recently at a conference about an equal and opposite truth. So whenever you're feeling like, oh, I'm terrible at this, or I'm the worst at this, or I'd never succeed at this, or I shouldn't be here because whatever, rather than try to sort of convince yourself that you're not the worst at this, maybe I'm the best at this, actually just go, okay, well, maybe that's true. But here's an equal and opposite truth that might be, well, okay, I'm not sure why are people listening to me talk? What have I got to say that's interesting? I'm just a person. But equally true is the fact that I receive really great feedback all of the time from the work that I do with people, and it's made a difference to people's lives. So who cares if this particular person that's listening to me doesn't appeal to it, So I do think finding those equal and opposite truths to help you see that even if it seems like you're not ready, or you're not perfect, or you're the worst at this, even if that's true, there are other truths out there too that negate the one that you're thinking.
Gosh, and I think remembering that, that thoughts are not facts, and many of the things you're thinking are not always actually true anyway. Like I think that that's, you know what I mean? Like I think we just plague ourselves with so much that isn't the reality. The other thing that talking about kind of that science of unstuck, the thing that I heard in this podcast actually that I thought was really powerful was, that also the idea that you really need to be able to let go of things that have happened in the past. I know that's easier said than done, but and also be kind to yourself. The guy on this podcast said, forgiveness is giving up all hope of a better past. And it took me a minute to really kind of think of. I love that. I don't know where that's from. It's some sort of proverb or something. But forgiveness is giving up all hope of a better past. That you. I spent a huge amount of time being like, I've made so many mistakes and I've done this wrong. And actually, I mean, okay, I mean, maybe that's true, but equally, I can't do anything about it. You know what I mean? And you do have to be able to move past things. Easier said than done, but that's definitely helped me, I suppose. So, bringing us sort of forward to your day-to-day life now. So, how does a day look for you? What do you do? What do you do?
Yeah, so I have the very advanced privilege, and when I was doing my own life design on myself, this is absolutely on purpose. I have an incredibly varied week. So a couple of days a week, I'm interim manager for a vet clinic, which works really well for me. Nice and stable. I have a small child. It's very responsible of me to have a stable income. And then the other days of the week, I do everything from will be. This last week I've presented presentations for veterinary chains on mindset and thriving in the veterinary profession. I have regular coaches that I meet with once a week to help them on their next steps on their journey. And I also run a mastermind program where people can come in and do a program with colleagues that are in the same position as them over the next sort of 3 months. And we go, all right, well, here's where you are. Here's where you want to be. Now let's hold each other accountable for that. And a lot of what I do really is working with leaders in vet clinics on putting their money where their mouth is, helping their people be engaged and productive and fulfilled and well where they are. Because, ultimately, whilst it sounds ironic that I coach people on how to not necessarily be a clinician anymore, my ultimate goal in life is to help the veterinary profession become sustainable. And that's for individuals and for the industry. So, how do we keep people here and well and engaged so that they can have long, fulfilled careers with the industry? But on an individual basis, what does that look like for you? Because, in my personal experience, a part-time vet is a happy vet. And so, if I can, help somebody with an intervention, that means that they can get what they need out of a couple of days a week in a clinical role and a couple of days a week in a non-clinical role that suits and brings to their life the things that they were missing otherwise, then to me, that's a huge success. So for me, yeah, it's all really about balancing the sustainability of the industry.
Agreed, and I think that that it's different for everyone. I mean, it really is just making it work for you. And I think that's really, really important. Do you, as far as becoming unstuck, which sounds like it's a lot of the work that you do, if people are feeling like that, what do you think is the, what's the key to that in your opinion? What's the key of the science of becoming unstuck?
Look, I think, as we both agreed, there is a belief that you might just have, one day have an epiphany and it will all be okay from then on in. And look, for some people that happens, health scares or a major life event that they have no choice about and the world is undone and they have to rebuild. Some people do have that experience. But in my experience, for most people, it's acknowledging and committing to waking up every day and deciding to do something else. That you can be happy somewhere else, but that's a choice. That life is a series of choices that we make on an every day, every hour basis to get what we want out of it. And not everybody likes that. I think a lot of people, it's a little bit, diet culture is a really good example. Nobody wants to kind of commit to, okay, I'm going to eat quite well for the rest of my life. We all want to do a 12-week fad diet and then we're going to be fine. And then I just have to maintain it. It'll be fine once I've lost all the weight. But the reality is that's not life. We're grown-ass adults and our metabolisms are what they are, and life is what it is. And we have to commit to doing the work every single day.
I hear you. I feel like, yeah, I think we need to chat more. I feel like you could really help me. You're a grown ass adult. Come on now. Just come on with
We are grown
it.
ass adults, and don't get me wrong, I am strongly in the camp of people who regularly look around for an adultier adult than me that can make harder decisions than
Oh
I
my
can.
God. I'm gonna where there's so many t-shirts we're gonna get made after this. So an adult here that I want is it is that there's is there is this are these Australianisms or are these just your phrases?
No, that's a meism, I think. One of my favorite memes of all time is, don't you hate when you're looking around you for someone who's more of an adult than you are, and then you realize that you are the adult in the room, and it's most upsetting.
Right,
But that is
isn't
life
it?
now,
Where
people.
gosh, isn't that really true? And yeah, I was talking yesterday at a CPD of CE event, and someone was, when people introduce you and it's really awkward because they read out your bio and you're like, and it feels a bit cringy, and it almost like they were it was almost like they were talking about someone else, and I was like, who is that guy? I don't feel like I feel I
Sounds
don't feel
really
like I've
grown up.
doesn't he sound really good? Like he is so successful. I was like, that is, if only they knew. Even then, if only they knew the truth about me. Like that, honestly, like I'm joking aside, that is exactly what I was thinking in my mind. If only they knew the truth about me, they wouldn't be so impressed.
Yeah, but
True,
both of those
truly.
things are true, Scott. It's the equal and opposite truth, isn't it? That you can be horrifically impressive and a fumbling idiot who constantly burns your toast. Like, both of those things don't have to be mutually exclusive.
It's so interesting, isn't it? So I think you'll in your day-to-day life, I'm sure you get to see just such a colorful array of different individuals. I'm sure, without putting words in your mouth, that is a joy. I wonder if you could share with us a little bit about who inspires you particularly.
Ooh, that's a good one. Look, for me, I have a bit of what I call a career crush on Dr. Andy Rourke.
Oh, nice. That's okay.
Yeah, so not a crush, just a career crush. Like, I want his career. I just think that I was introduced to Dr. Andy Rourke when I watched a video of his that was about happiness versus joy in the veterinary industry. And it was about, the life is suffering and we get to choose our suffering. And that you could look at that as depressing, but an example that he gives in the story that he tells very well and very authentically, because he's just lost his elderly dog of 15 odd years, and he sort of says, look, the pain is horrific. It's awful. It's absolutely mind-blowingly difficult to lose the dog. But the other choice was to not have a dog, and for every single day to come home to an empty house and no companion and nobody through all of these, major life events with me. And those are the choices that I'm offered, and so of course I'm going to have had the dog and choose that suffering that I'm feeling now rather than the suffering of 15 years without him. And I thought it was a really lovely story that, whilst it's got sad insight, he's talking about the veterinary career of what we do matters to people, and so people get mad at us because we're mixing love and money, and that's inevitably going to lead to a lot of heartache and a lot of frustration, a lot of anger. But equally, you could be doing something else. And, people at McDonald's get shouted at strangely regularly too. And, people on production lines have unattainable goals. And people in dentist office have terrible bosses. it's that kind of, well, we choose our suffering. But as long as we're consciously making those choices, then that's okay. And so, yes, I think that was when I was first introduced to Dr. Rourke. And ever since then, everything he does, I just think, really spot on in terms of his approach to people. And yeah, so that's somebody that I really look up to, really want to be like, when I'm an adult, that's who I want to be.
And then I'm here to remind you that you are the adult, I'm afraid to say, and
I
people
know.
are.
And do you know what I've done very recently is I reached out to Dr. Andy Rourke and said, Hey, so I have a massive career crush on you. Will you talk to me for a few minutes and tell me how you did what you did? And guess what? He said yes because he's a very nice person. So that was
Did
me trying to be
he?
an adult, is I'm just going to go, do you know what? I'm just going to reach out and say hello.
Oh, and what? So tell me, I'm interested now in this. Feels like it's turned into a dating show, a career dating show. So this has inspired me. Who can I
Career dating.
talk to?
Remember, I'm a
I
career
know, no, I
coach.
know.
Career dating is all
Sorry.
about what I do.
Well, it depends how I edit this podcast. It could be edited very different. No, I'm joking. No. So how did that, tell me how that did he chat to you? Was that, did you,
He did.
oh, that's
Yeah,
so
he offered me
kind.
half
Isn't
an
that
hour of his
nice?
time, and then it ended up being an hour and a half because not because I didn't keep asking questions. He kept talking. He was very lovely, and
How lovely is that? Well, that's so nice,
yeah.
isn't it? But, and I suppose that's one of those things where, you know, when the, I don't know, I don't hate to say celebrity, but when the person who's, you know, you reach out to you is actually, you know, that it can go one of two ways. They can either be a complete dick or they can be really nice. And that really does
I was
make,
nervous, the don't meet your heroes thing, but no, he was lovely.
And that's so lovely. And actually what you've shared there from him is really powerful. I really love that. And it's made me think I need to go back and revisit him because I'm not sure that I thought that he said things like that. So that's really very cool. So, that's really, really cool. So that was a great answer. I really like that. That was very good.
I'm pleased that my dating show is working for
Yeah,
you.
really, I really love that. So, you know, as far as obviously where you're at, you know, where you are now, you know, do you think that you still, you know, looking back with the power of hindsight, would you still, if you could do it all again, would you still go to vet school?
It's a really important question. And my dad asked me that only this year, actually. He said, oh, what could we have done to talk you out of it back then? And I think there's two parts of the answer to that question. And the first one is nothing. I was a know-it-all 17-year-old who actually many people did tell me. I actually spoke to vets who told me don't do it. So the answer is just frankly, 17-year-olds are 17-year-olds and they don't know enough about themselves to have any insight into what will be their life.
Into
But
into
secondly, I
anything.
am to anything. Yes, that's true. But the second part of the answer is I'm so pleased nobody did. I have an amazing career. I have traveled the world. I have, you know, done things that people would pay thousands of dollars for, whether it's lion cubs at the zoo, or I've done tours of Botswana helping, pull leopards out of barbed wire. I've managed shelters in tropical islands and locums in scuba diving resorts in Thailand. I have met all of my best friends from the veterinary industry, the godmother of my child. I would never ever trade any of that. And I think that's a really important part to be really clear on is there isn't this kind of, if I hadn't done vet, I could have done something else. It's, I did vet and now I'm here. And if I hadn't done vet, I wouldn't be here. And I can't imagine a different life. It's all good and well to go, oh, well, I could have more money or I could work less hard or whatever. But I love my career. I love the choices that I've made. I force myself on a daily basis to make sure I'm making choices on the path of least regret, which is, a mantra that I hold to very strongly that every single time I'm like, I don't know what to do. It's what will I regret least? And I know for a fact that if I was my age now and I'd gone to medical school or I'd done something totally other, I would regret not being a vet. Whereas I get to not regret that because I did it, I used it, I used it as a platform off which I've built the career of one's dreams.
Good for you. So, what are you going to be then when you grow up?
Now that's a good question. So I've stolen my life vision right off a fourth year vet student who I've doing some guest lecturing for their veterinary professional life course, and we were setting SMART goals. And I was having this conversation, and because I had to mark them on engagement, so I needed every single person in the room to say something. And it was this very shy young man at the back, and he was, all of 20, did not want to speak in public, but everybody else had. And I kind of had to poke him and make him say something so that I could give him a mark. But we'd right at the end, and we'd done, 1 month goals and 5 year goals and life goals and how to make them smart and, all of those things. And finally, I was like, you're going to have to give me an answer. So he shares his life goal with the whole class. And his life goal is that by the time he's 80, his grandkids will have three different stories about him that they can brag to their friends about. And I was like, you got your shit together. Sorry, can I say that on your website? But
We'll do that
you can
Australian.
edit,
The
right?
guest is Australian. We'll do a
Yeah.
disclaimer. They sometimes say things like that. No, I'm joking.
Yeah, we should have put that disclaimer at the beginning. I apologize. But yeah, that was it. I've stolen my life ambition from a 20-year-old kid. Because from here on in, like I say, I've got the family that I didn't, it's not how I imagined it, but I love it. I've got a career that is not how I imagined it, but I love it. I have a lifestyle that, copy and repeat, basically. And what comes next? Who knows? Who cares? Because I know that I've got the skills at life design to decide, is it in line with who I want to be? What do I next want out of my life? And then how do I build my work to fulfill that? And I'm thinking, once my dog dies, don't tell him that. Once my elderly dog passes away, then me and my kid are probably going to spend 3 or 4 years before she's too old to want to, traveling the world. Consulting for 3 months at a time in various different exciting locations, because I can, because our career allows that. And if you can see the wonderful, wonderful opportunities that are in front of you, if you're willing to step up and make those choices every day, life can be pretty cool.
Gosh, you're also very cool. Did you know that? Has anyone ever told you? I think you're a very, very cool person. And I
Thank you. I was
feel
very
that,
uncool in high school. Otherwise, I wouldn't have gone into vet school. So
well,
I appreciate that. You don't get told that often in your adult life.
I already am kind of looking forward to editing this because I feel like, there's some podcasts you listen to where you're taking notes, and I really do feel there's so many things you said that I'm going to have to write down and stick on my wall. So thank you so much for taking the time to chat to us today. I really, really appreciate it.
You so much for having me.
A massive thank you again to Jess for chatting today. Just a real honour to chat to you, and also so many things that I've taken away from that conversation, particularly around choosing your own suffering. And I think that gentle reminder that we are not the only profession that has our challenges. So I also found that super useful. So thank you again, Jess, for chatting. We're now going into our clinical segment where we're joined by Lucy and Katie from Protexin. And we're super thankful and grateful to Protexin for supporting this clinical chat today. Lucy is a veterinary surgeon who has spent many years working in first opinion practice and is now a veterinary technical advisor for Protexin. And Katie, a registered veterinary nurse, also a seasoned practitioner, and also has an advanced diploma in behaviour and training, veterinary behaviour and training. And she is a territory manager with Protexin. We're really excited to be chatting to Lucy and Katie today about the really difficult topic in many ways of behaviour and how we can go about spotting behavioural concerns in our patient, and also how to open up that conversation with owners around behaviour and what we can do to ultimately help the patients in our care. The one thing I would say to start with is that behaviour generally is a topic that people kind of do recoil a little bit with in practice, because a lot of vets particularly, and I'll not tarnish maybe vet nurses with the same brush, but a lot of vets particularly just don't feel confident in advising on that topic. And the problem, I think, is that a lot of owners want to ask questions about that topic, and I still feel like that in my work now, where I'm dealing with very specific disease processes, but people will still ask me questions about the, you know, behavioral components of that. And I feel very underqualified to, you know, to discuss that. So let's start, Katie, with sort of a, right back at the start of the whole process. So when an owner, or when a, you know, a patient and their carer come into the consulting room, you know, anxiety or an anxious animal is something that you're going to be often faced with. What do you think, you know, as far as you as a veterinary professional noticing that anxiety or anxiousness within an animal at the very beginning, how do you think you should be approaching maybe helping or dealing with that sort of problem without maybe making the owner feel, I suppose, alienated? You know, is that something that you can bring up early on within the consultation?
I think it is. And I think it's something that perhaps isn't highlighted enough, either perhaps because of the time restraints, or like yourself, you're a bit like, oh God, I don't want to open that can of worms. But certainly, you know, I think it definitely is something that can easily be highlighted in a way that doesn't alienate your owner. Because of course, the last thing we want to be doing is saying, oh, by the way, you know, do you know your animal's got these anxiety signals? That's just opening a can of worms. So I almost like to open a dialogue as I'm going through a consultation, that if I see things happening, actually tell the client that that's what I'm seeing, and I'm just doing this because of this. And I don't think there's any hiding behind an anxiety animal. Of course, animals are going to be anxious, just like we would be if we were going to the doctors or dentist. It's perfectly acceptable. But I think sometimes there's a little bit of sort of stigmatism around, why aren't we highlighting this? Is it because they shouldn't be feeling like this? And that's absolutely not the case. But ultimately, how can we combat that with vet, owner and animal to find a compromise?
I think that's a really interesting point, actually, to say that. I think even just that mindset, just being like, well, they're allowed to be anxious. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think that, and I do wonder whether we often do alienate people and the patients, you know, sometimes because we label them with certain labels when they behave in a certain way. You know what I mean? So we give them sometimes almost warning signs, you know, this animal is, I don't know, anxious, aggressive, whatever, you know. And so I think sometimes we do just need to take a step back and just say, well, actually, it's totally fine to feel like this. I love that. You know, how do you feel when you go to the dentist? Totally and utterly terrified. You know what I mean? And that will equally, that will change our behavior as human beings. So I think that's, you know, that's a really, really valid point. So do you have any sort of tips then about, you know, what people can do in the consulting room to start, I suppose, getting owners on board, particularly with how we can improve the situation to maybe even improve some of that, you know, that anxiety or anxious feeling for the patient?
Yeah, the difficult aspect with this is often behaviour takes time, and that's something that is limited within a veterinary practice. But if you've got an animal coming in and they're clearly showing you signs of anxiety, give them a little bit of time before, you know, the expectation of the owner to whatever, put them up on the consulting room table, or you dive straight into a clinical, you know, examination. Why not have the client into the room and just say to the client, I'm just going to be typing some notes why the dog or cat acclimatizes to the situation, and then take some history about the problem or whatever it is, why that dog or cat then has time to acclimatize to the different smells, the different people, and that type of thing within the practice. I think that is, yes, it takes time before you examine them, but ultimately you're then explaining what you're doing and typing your notes up, which ultimately will save you time at the end as well. So it's sort of marrying that time restraint up, but certainly giving the animal time to adapt to their surroundings can be a massive change from the animal's point of view.
One to one of the things that I think we find, and this is not just about this topic, but I think just with everything that we do, you know, language can be very important. And I do, and one of the things I'm always struck by is also the way that we sometimes use language that seems, we were joking about this before, actually, you know, when you talk to your vet friends or your you know, people in the industry, and you say some things, and I, if people were to overhear that conversation, I mean, sometimes I think you might be arrested. But I think that, you know what I mean? Like, we say some really odd things, don't we? Like, really odd things to each other. Once we've kind of broached the subject of, you know, your animal is behaving in a certain way, might be showing some signs of being, you know, anxious in the consulting room, how do we kind of move forward from there?
Yeah, I think it's probably worthwhile to point out that most owners probably aren't aware of quite mild signs of anxiety, and potentially this is what the, you know, the veterinary staff might be alluding to. But I don't think it's something that, yeah, we're saying that it's completely normal within the environment that they're in, but the reason for mentioning it is perhaps it would be appropriate for the clinical staff to say, well, I'm going to make a note that they have looked at me in this certain way, that they're yawning and showing some mild signs of anxiety. Not that it's anything to be concerned about because of the environment they're in, but if we've made notes to this point, then we can see if there's any escalation at further visits, and then we may need to consider doing something additional in the future. I don't think it's necessarily, oh, your dog's got anxiety, we need to do this or we need to do this. I think it's about, if you're showing very mild signs, highlighting it that it is normal within that context, but the reason you brought it up is so it can therefore be logged. And then if there is a progression in that anxiety level, you've got a note of what it started at, and then we can address it down the line should it become necessary. Some dogs may just find it a little bit anxious the whole time and just yawn, and there might be nothing else at all. But other dogs might start yawning, they then might start avoiding or trying to hide or jumping off the consulting room table, you know, or flickering their ears. And if we start to then see a progression in every time they go to be handled, they wet themselves, or there's, you know, there's a progression in that level of anxiety, then we can address it. So I don't think it's necessarily we're mentioning it because we want to do something immediately. We're sort of laying that seed that you've seen this. And then if the owner elaborates that also they do that in other situations, then you may want to escalate a chat sooner. But I think it's in the veterinary context, I think it's very important. And sometimes I think we're missing a bit of information in that if we just put a couple of lines in the clinical notes, the next person that then sees that animal, it will flag to them that they're anxious. And then they will automatically give them that little bit of extra time and reassurance, which it doesn't take much time to write a couple of sentences that it's showing mild signs of anxiety, but ultimately the next person that sees it is going to save them time because they don't jump in feet first. They've read the notes. And also, of course, the client then gets reassured by that fact, because if you're the second vet that's seen them, you can say, well, the vet mentioned last time that there may be some anxiety. So what I'm going to do now, I'm just going to type the notes up, give them some time to relax, introduce myself, and then move forward. So I think for the client's point of view, it helps to start to paint the picture rather than this is the information, you need to have it all now. It's more about planting the seed and let it sort of grow, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And do you think it's important to write in the clinical notes more than just dog is anxious? I mean, I presume it's more information than that is valuable.
Yeah, I think if you can put the, you know, the type of symptoms, because of course we've got mild, we've got moderate, and we've got severe. Of course, if the dog shows no signals at all and then suddenly lunges to a bite you, ultimately veterinary staff need to know that that's that dog's MO. But if you've got a client who's just trying to hide its head from you, submissive almost, yawning, that's still worth mentioning that that's what they do. Because often those types of clients that are anxious, it may well be if you're doing something strange for them, that actually something as simple as just covering their eyes so they can't directly see what's going might be enough of a coping mechanism for them. So it's about giving as much information as we can, so then when we move forward, you've got past information to rely on, because a dog will generally always go down a similar path when it comes to behavior pathways for that individual.
I think that you mentioned a couple of things there that I think are really important. I mean, I think that I think first of all, just being aware of the signs actually to look for, but also time comes up again and again, the limitations on people's time to maybe make a note of or talk about or deal with these situations. I can envisage a scenario where people are at the very end of a already relatively short consultation, and either you notice some behavior, or maybe the owner even says, "Oh, he's anxious today," or "She's anxious today," whatever. I think that I do worry that sometimes these things are like afterthoughts that maybe just get shoehorned in at the end. So because people are so worried about doing X, Y, and Z. You mentioned, and I think it would be helpful for people to maybe just run through some of the less obvious signs of anxiety that we might see in our cats and dogs that maybe, I don't know, maybe are not just always so glaringly obvious. I think that would be something that maybe people, and that's something that maybe people could make a little note of if they, rather than just those obvious signs of, I don't know, trying to run out the room or biting or whatever else. So I don't know if you can just chat, Katie, about some of the symptoms that people might look for, maybe the ones that they're not so used to maybe detecting.
The important thing here is that the majority of veterinary staff will know quite mild symptoms comparative to an owner. I mean, for instance, I can be sat in a waiting room most days and dogs will yawn and owners will look at the dog and go, "How can you be tired? You haven't done anything." They don't make the connection that they're anxious about waiting in a veterinary environment. So we at Protexin have actually made some literature client facing called Spot the Signs, and it breaks down anxiety to dogs and cats and into three separate categories, so sort of mild, moderate, and severe. So it would be about, so mild, for instance, lip licking, lip smacking, yawning, cowering, lowering the tail, particularly tucking it between the legs, tail flicking. Cats in particular like to flick their tail, they like to hide. Both dogs and cats will avoid objects or, try and get away if they can. But also they will also try and avoid eye contact. And as a species, humans like to have eye contact with one another, and quite often that can really aggravate anxiety. And that can be one massive thing to try and avoid, if you are trying not to be confrontational to a dog or cat, which is very difficult if they've got an eye problem. But ultimately, trying to not do something that's going to intimidate them by keeping those signs in mind. And certainly, it's a resource that we have available that I'm sure we can put up at the end so that people can access it should they require it for their veterinary practice.
And I just think sometimes it is just that reminder of these things. I think that's the thing. It's not always, in people's minds, and I think that just having a little bit of a nudge to think, oh, actually that thing or that, eye contact or whatever, I think is really valuable. What about, I mean, I suppose, the vets is a really obvious situation where everyone's anxious. I don't know, I'm anxious, my God. But anyway, that's another story. I think that, again, the problem, with a lot of this, is that we don't always know what to do. So let's say an owner is in a situation, Katie, where we've seen some signs of anxiety in the vets. We've then realized that actually when this, when the animal is left, in the home without people there, then there's signs of separation anxiety. And actually, when the dog went to the kennels for the first time, it was an absolute nightmare, you know, for, you know, for whatever reason. So I suppose what then should our, you know, caregivers be doing when they notice that these signs are actually cropping up in more than one scenario? It's not just about going to see the veterinary team.
Yeah, and I think if it is something that's showing in multiple aspects of their life, even from, you know, if it's a social, they get stressed when there's multiple animals in a social situation, that is something that potentially is going to need work. The difficulty being the behaviour industry is extremely unregulated. It's not like the veterinary industry. So unfortunately, pretty much anybody can call themselves a trainer or a behaviourist. So certainly if they can get the appropriate advice at the veterinary clinic, or even a recommendation from a veterinary clinic as to where to go next. And it may well be just some simple advice within somebody who has an interest in that area in a veterinary practice is appropriate. We're not saying it's necessarily at that stage a full referral, but obviously if they're showing quite rapidly and, you know, different signs that are then going into not a mild category anymore, or they're reacting more and more, or more importantly, they're taking a long time to calm down after these incidents, we can all be startled, but we get over it very quickly and move on. But if an animal gets stuck in that anxious phase and isn't able to cope and calm down, that is something that then will need potentially professional help. So hopefully there's somebody that most veterinary clinics have a point of call if they're not in the veterinary practice that they can refer people, or certainly point in the right direction. But again, it's something that is unregulated. And if owners are coming to veterinary practices saying, what do you think of this person? Don't be afraid to ask what their credentials are, would be my underlying, make sure that they have got an appropriate level of qualification. And the first time that a voice is raised or there's any sort of negative or punishment, absolutely run to the hills and go and find somebody else, because we certainly should not be telling these dogs off or shouting at them or punishing them in any way. That is only going to make these matters worse.
But I think actually just having having thought about this, you know, like you say, the behavior industry is, you know, the structure of that is definitely, and it's ever changing. I've been at a couple of discussions recently, you know, about this, and I think, you know, what we need to do in veterinary practice really is just have an idea of who our people are going to be that we're going to go to in these situations, actually, and just having thought about it and at least having a bit of a plan, so you've got a list of people or a person that you can recommend to owners, I think is really the first step. Because a lot of times I think people are like, oh, I don't even know who would I send you to see about that thing, I don't really know, you know. And so I think sometimes people just don't know what resources are out there. So doing a little bit of homework about who you might use in those sorts of scenarios is a good idea, I think, because it's so easy to know if my dog has uncontrolled diabetes, I'm going to send it to an internal medicine specialist, or, you know, if my dog has a broken leg, I'm going to send it here. But we don't always have that same knowledge about behavioral problems, and that can be just useful to have done a little bit of homework, I think, in that area. You said it was interesting, you said that, you know, obviously the severity of the signs will depend a little bit on who you send the patient too, but you sort of alluded to the fact that there still can be a lot that we do in practice day to day to try and help in these situations, and maybe just having someone in your practice that has a bit of an oversight. I don't know if I'm not putting words in your mouth, but just as a bit of an interest in maybe the client experience and actually improving some of the day to day running of the practice, just to help patients' journey be a little bit more palatable. Would that be fair, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, we're, going back to that time aspect again of veterinary practices don't have time. And by making a little note on your clinical record, if that animal has showed mild signs of anxiety and what that is, ultimately, when that patient next comes in, that vet has already, or that nurse has already seen the clinical notes from before and can straight away give that animal a little bit more space and time to adapt. If we are seeing that we're going up into, things like excessively panting, drooling, we're starting to make a lot of noise, anything like that, then we can then do things like just socialization visits to the practice. A lot of veterinary clinics now have specialized front of house staff that there's no reason why you couldn't just bring them into the waiting room environment, let them have a chat. In the waiting room, you don't need to actually see anybody potentially at that stage, and then go out. So that animal actually learns that actually being in the waiting room doesn't mean that I'm going to get hauled into a room and a finger stuck up my bum or, anything like that. And just giving them, with anxiety, often once you get into that anxious pattern, it'll be things beforehand that trigger it off. So, like going to the vet, if your dog only goes into the car to go to the vet, it may well be that actually going into cars is what starts the anxiety trail. So the same as with in the veterinary clinic, often the animals start to get wound up as soon as they're in the waiting room. So if you've got a quite proactive client that will happily, regularly just bring the dog into the waiting room just to have a wander around and a sniff and then go out again, quite often that could delay the start of that anxiety. And the shorter period of time, of course, these animals are anxious for, the better it's going to be for them, and the less time they've got to then escalate that anxiety if they're not coping with it.
And Lucy, I think if you have a if we have an interested owner who is who wants to know more or understand more, or it's always good to have somewhere to send people, particularly with owners. What kind of resources then are available for owners to have a little bit more of a think about this sort of thing? Is there anything we can be sending them to that might be helpful?
Yeah, so I mean, this was something that was a massive thing we were thinking of, to be honest, this time element. And often it's right at the end of a consult that it's mentioned and you don't have any time to do anything. So we've at Protectin made an owner booklet which has information like the spot the signs Katie was mentioning, as well as behaviorist qualifications to look for, because again, that's something that can really help the vet speed things up by saying, look here, just double check they have one of these qualifications. We know they're good qualifications. So we have that, which again, if people contact us, we can send out.
What do you say to them as far as understanding whether they need a trainer or a behaviorist? I'm never sure of exactly the word. That's so ignorant. I don't actually know. But you mentioned things like trainer. How do we start to pick apart the difference between maybe those things and what owners actually or caregivers actually need for for our patients?
Yeah, I think a trainer would be appropriate in very young animals. So puppies that perhaps you've not had a puppy before and you need guidance about generally getting them used to everyday life and the types of things that you could be doing and give the owner the basic information. It may well be that you stay with a trainer from puppyhood and then you go down different avenues with that. But for any sort of behavioral concern, particularly anxiety, if you have got that escalation in anxiety, then a behaviorist is what I would be looking for rather than a trainer. With behavior problems, unfortunately, it's not friendly to a veterinary environment because these things often take a lot of time. And I think the difficulty being when you do refer to a behaviorist, sometimes there is a long wait to see an appropriately qualified behaviorist, but also there is aspects, it's not something that you can take them to the vets and say, oh yeah, give this pill and it will do that. And I think sometimes the owner perception is that they need to be medicated. So the veterinary profession feel pressure to perhaps medicate before they've been assessed. And it's weighing up that pros and cons list about doing that type of thing. So I think if you do have a behaviorist within a practice, or they work with, closely with a behaviorist, then definitely that is an option to be doing earlier rather than later. We always say with behavior, when we're talking about mild signs, we're talking about resolution of the issue. Once we get into moderate or severe, we then start to use words like management of the condition. So I think sometimes owners come when they're, you know, you hear it all the time. Oh, well, it's always been a bit like this, but it's bitten a few times, but now it's bitten my child. I think I need to do something. Whereas actually, if things that have been highlighted very early and very mild, perhaps when there wasn't that escalation, and then as soon as that escalation starts, then you can start looking down the referral. So almost before you think you're going to need it is better to do it from an owner point of view, purely because, you know, once a dog has bitten, that's what its MO will always go back to. So if we can pick up signs prior to the dog feeling pressured that it has to do that and address it, then hopefully we don't put that dog under that pressure to then have that outburst of emotion and behavior like that. So I think it is something that we often use as a last resort. Whereas I think if the more we talk about it, the earlier we talk about it, the quicker we can get on top of it and actually resolve these issues with appropriate people.
But I think, Lucy, maybe that's a theme here that has come out for me, where actually a lot of this is trying to actually be more proactive. You know, this is like, it's almost like preventative medicine. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like that we move towards much more preventative medicine for very many things, whether it be vaccinations or worming treatment. But actually, this is maybe something that we have to think about in a similar way, where we have to think, well, actually, from the very beginning, we should be jumping in with stuff to help these people.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think, you know, the more we've been talking, obviously, at Protexin a lot about behaviour, and I've been learning loads from Katie, which is
me too
frustrating once you're already out of practice. So I'm like, no, I could have used it. But I think a lot of what I've learned is similar to what you were saying, is actually this open communication between ourselves, other staff members, and the owners is going to end up reducing the necessity for it to be this massive big deal when we talk about it, because we've left it so long. Like you said at the start, if in our notes we only make a note when a dog's tried to bite us, or, you know, a cat's needed held by two nurses to get an injection, then it makes it much more of a thing. Whereas if actually we know as a clinic, we write on the majority, you know, let's not kid ourselves, the majority of animals are going to show some form of anxiety. As we said, that's normal. If it's very normal for us to write literally just a few words at the end of a consult to highlight that, it becomes the norm that we're discussing behavior. And again, with clients, Katie and I were talking before, and she was saying, you know, you can then, I was always nervous to bring it up because I felt like then it would be another half an hour discussion about behavior and about, you know, things that, like you said, us vets aren't actually that knowledgeable about. I think that's the key.
Yeah. We don't actually know.
And I think actually we forget we do know more than the owner. We do pick up on those mild signs. We do know the first few steps we can take. And even by just at the end of a consult saying, you know, your animal has shown XYZ signs of mild anxiety today, we would expect that. We're in the vet practice, but I am just going to make a little note on the file today, just so we're aware, in case it's not me you see next time, we're aware to take things a little bit slower. And if they do start showing any signs like this outside the practice, just let us know and we can discuss it in a full appointment another time. And it's just that signposting constantly. And I think if we say it in a way that we are acknowledging it again, non-judgmentally, not trying to alienate, but we're acknowledging it in the hopes that the next experience will be better, then I think it takes that defensiveness away from the owner as well. We're doing it because we're trying to help everyone. It helps, you know, the clinic to understand their time management, maybe have a nurse ready to hold that animal immediately next time, so we don't end up having a struggle for 5 minutes, then get the nurse in when things have just got so escalated. We have options. And then if 1, 2, 3 consults time, things have escalated, or we need to, you know, ask later in the consult someone to come in and hold, it's not this big shock to the owner, which is often also what alienates them. So I think it's just making it the norm that it's something we talk about.
And I think, I mean, I don't want to speak out of turn, the practice I'm in currently, the practice management system, Katie, I'd love to know what you thought about this. The practice management system allows us to label individual patients with a number of chili peppers, like on the, so the, I won't tell you what practice management system it is. It's I really like the system apart from this. So at rounds in the morning, you know, we've got this screen up of all the different patients we're discussing. And in one of the boxes, there's literally chili peppers. And obviously the more chili peppers are in this box, the more spicy the patient is, right? And so therefore I am making immediate assumptions about some individual patient's behavior based on chili peppers. Do you think that's a good system?
Not really, no.
No, I don't either. I think it's terrible.
I think I'm trying to be politically correct, which is a very...
You don't have to be. We've not named the system. We've not named the system.
I think the difficulty there is if you have... Why are they spicy? Are they spicy because they're in pain at that particular time? In which case, if you're going to then clinically do a full examination and pull on bits that already hurt, you're going to get that spicy reaction. It's obvious that's actually your fault, not the patient's fault, you know? So I think there are a lot of circumstances associated with that. And I think that is a very sort of generalized, blinkered way of looking at it. Because like you said, you will look at it and say, oh, this animal's got 3 chili peppers. That means it's naughty. It might be that just its pain wasn't under control at that particular point, or it was extremely anxious because it had just been removed from the arms of its loved ones. So I think it's a very generalized sort of way of looking at it. And I'd rather it be, you know, much more word specific. You know, if that animal was spicy, my first reaction would be, why? Is it in pain?
Yeah.
Is it, or its needs not being met? Its emotional state obviously is affected. That all needs to be corrected before we, you know, go and get all the old school restraints out, shall we say.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think, and actually there's a number of vet nurses that are very vocal online, particularly now, you know, vet nurses that are friends of the podcast who I'm sure will, who are very dedicated to listening and will be listening, but, you know, Lacey and Nikki, who actually have done a number of social media posts about the use of language like spicy and how unhelpful it is, you know, and actually, you know, thinking about how we talk about our patients when they are showing certain behavioural traits. I think we have to be very careful about how we discuss that. And also, I think coming back to what we kind of initially talked about is, you know, also thinking about the way that we record that information. So I think my point being that I don't find the chili peppers very helpful, and actually that's not, I don't think it's very fair. I would hate to think that in hospital I'd been labeled with, you know, 5 chili peppers because I was being an absolute tool that day, you know. So I think that, anyway, never mind. So but it was an interesting thing that I observed, and I had it in my mind, you know, as we were having this discussion. Okay, so lots of interesting things we could chat all day. I don't know if you would both, just to sort of finish up, if you both would mind sharing just a sort of, you know, you know, you've obviously got a lot of experience now with discussing these sorts of issues with veterinary professionals. I don't know if you have a, Lucy, if you have a sort of top tip when it comes to, you know, how veterinary professionals should be managing cases that maybe, as you've said, you know, we're less comfortable talking about behaviour. Any top tips from your perspective?
Honestly, I think the biggest thing is we don't have to know everything. If you think about it in the case of any other type of disease, we do it in stages. We don't make a diagnosis immediately and give a treatment immediately. Mm-hmm. I think with behaviour, because we feel such a lack of knowledge, we feel like if as soon as we mention behaviour, we need to have a complete plan laid out. We need to know exactly why the behaviour is happening, mm-hmm. discuss it for an hour with the client. And actually, mm-hmm. it's like Katie said before, I think if we bring it up and start planting those seeds in their head, they often, that kind of combative atmosphere that can sometimes come from discussing it doesn't need to happen, because we don't need to have a huge discussion initially. You know, depends on the level of severity of signs they're showing, but we can do it step by step. And it's also okay to say, I'm not a specialist in this field, but here's where to send you. Again, like we would refer an internal medicine case or any case, that there are always next levels that have more knowledge than us. And it's okay to say that to a client. We, you know, especially in general practice, you can't know everything about everything, but knowing the first few steps, which I think we've discussed today, of just acknowledging it, getting a client on board, knowing the signs for them to look for. Once we've done that, really our role is to know where to send them initially. Yes. And I think it's just, I don't know why it's so behavior specific that we feel we have to suddenly know everything about it when we don't feel that way about any other field within veterinary. So I think that's the biggest thing for me, is it's okay to bring it up and not have all the answers.
But also I think having a plan in place, so having like, so just knowing on a bit of paper, well, we don't use bits of paper. Having somewhere that we've just got, this is what I'm going to tell them to do next. You know, having just a bit of a, you know, bringing, you know, having the practice meeting, just having a discussion. What are we going to do when owners say, I want advice on this? You know, I just think having that little bit of foresight and being prepared is massively helpful. But I think what you've said is really true. Like, it's, we have anxiety around the fact that we don't know the answer, and that's okay not to know sometimes, you know, for sure. Great, thank you. And Katie, anything you'd like to share?
I think just the most important thing is going back to like the chili peppers, going back to, we are very quick to try and push animals into a certain box. Every animal needs to be assessed as an individual in that moment in time. Just because the last time they came in and they were in pain and they felt like they had to bite doesn't mean that the minute they walk through the door they have to have a muzzle shoved on their face. You know, assess each animal as an individual, have a look at their emotional state, have a look at their anxiety levels, and then make steps accordingly. Just because it's happened once doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen every time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's very, very true. Great. Well, listen, thank you both very much for chatting today. Really interesting. So some really interesting things that have come up, and you know, again, you know, hopefully reassuring to people that just you're not doing a bad job just because you don't know all the answers, but just having a little bit of signposting knowledge and you know, just being able to send people in the right direction and knowing what that direction is, I think is really, really valuable for people. So thank you again for taking the time to chat. A A massive thank you again to Jess, to Lucy, and to Katie for chatting today. It's been a real honour to have all of you on the podcast, and lots of fun and very insightful conversations that we've had today. Massive thank you again to all of you for listening. We truly appreciate your support. Do remember to give the podcast you rate it, you give it a follow, something like that. Anyway, show your support if you can. Do give us a like, follow, and share also on social media. And to learn more about VTX and what we do, then head over to www.vtx-cpd.com. Thanks again, and I look forward to seeing you next time.